You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking with Sashir Zamata, a former SNL cast member and an incredibly accomplished stand-up and comic actor, as well as being someone who appears to be made out of pure willpower. Sashir is fantastic. I highly recommend you download a copy of Pizza Mind, her first stand-up special, and you can check out various sketches of hers on YouTube. She was Kaylee in, was Kaylee the character? In Black Jeopardy on SNL. She's very, very funny in that. So, I think I've said the right name there. Is it Kaylee? Maybe it's Kaylee. I don't know. I'm not, as we know from my embarrassing mistake during the Andy Daly episode, I'm not as conversant with SNL as many of you seem to be. This is a really interesting episode with a very self-assured, very funny and really inspiring human being. So without further ado, recorded at Montreal Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, this is Sashir Zamata. So I saw your show at the Catacombs. Does that show have a name? Does the show have, like your special, your first special, Pizza Mind, that's like a finished bit, there we go, that's
yeah.
The show. Where are we in the life of the material you're doing here in Montreal?
Yeah, what I did at my solo show here was a mix of stuff from Pizza Mind and then some new stuff, so there's no name for it. It was just an hour of material that I did here. So yeah, there's no, until I figure out what the new hour is, then I'll slap a name on it.
Okay. And how was your, were you doing a run? Have you got one left tonight?
No, I finished it. I did one Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday.
Okay. And yeah. How did they go? Were you happy?
They were so fun. Yeah. Like, the Monday crowd was super hyped and I didn't know what a Monday crowd would be like here, but it was great. Tuesday was very fun. And I felt like, my last night was like a great way to end it. So I'm very happy with how they went. Yeah.
Okay. And you're someone who, I mean, I suppose watching you completely, like having never seen you before, I was really struck. I think I said to you when I spoke to you yesterday, I was really struck by your incredible poise on stage.
Thanks.
You're so, is that something that gets said to you a lot? You have, you're kind of, you're not, it's not just your delivery, but your whole being on stage is so just kind of, here's the stuff.
Yeah.
It's incredibly easy to watch. You are demanding stuff of us intellectually, but you're not kind of, there's no sense of neediness at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been told that my style is more conversational. It feels like I'm just talking to friends than, you know, creating an audience performer relationship. And that's what I want. I want you to feel like, you know me and that we are here together and we're communicating, because we are. I mean, like, I am performing for you, but I also get feedback from you. I can see the audience and I can feel the energy. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship that we're all a part of.
And how much of it, how much of your delivery is a decision and how much of it is just naturally how you started off on stage?
I think now it feels natural, but I worked very hard to be chill. The chill vibe that you see on stage is from work, from years of work. Because when I started, you know, like every comic, you're a little stiff and you're trying to figure out how to, you know, perform in this body that is that is operating what you're saying. But yeah, I'm not sure when, but I was trying to just, you know, be more loose and feel more in the moment. And I think the biggest compliment to me is when people think that I made everything up on the spot and that I didn't write anything. Like, part of me is like, obviously I wrote this.
Can you appreciate incredibly hard work?
Exactly. Yeah. Give me credit for writing an hour. But also, that's cool that people think, like, I have such an ease about me that it's that I'm in the moment. That's what I want it to seem like.
Okay, so it's what you want it to seem like, and it's what you have kind of crafted it and trained it to be like. Yeah. So does that mean when you started out, you were kind of nervous or hyperactive? Or what did it look like? What were the differences between you now and you on gig one?
It wouldn't be nervous. It would just look like I was performing. You could see the work, you know?
Okay.
So that element has decreased where I am still working, but it just looks smoother.
And why is that particularly important to you? Given that of all of the comedians at this festival, you probably have the most kind of, poise, I don't know, it's not casual, whatever this quality is, I don't quite know how to articulate it. But given that that is a real calling card of your performance, why is that? Why was that so important to you?
I guess because that's what I like to see out of other performances that I watch. Like when I watch other people perform, when they are in the moment or they make discoveries on stage or in the room, you feel special. You feel like, oh, this show is just for me, as opposed to like, oh, they're performing in front of a audience and if you lifted this person and moved them to a different stage, it would feel like the exact same performance.
Yes.
So I don't want that. I want the people in the room to feel like this is just for them. And what I'm doing is a creation of how I feel right now.
Yes. Yes, I totally agree with that. I wonder what other things might be part of that as well. Is it something to do with status?
What do you mean?
Like, I think you're incredibly high status as a comic.
Oh.
But not in a way that you're looking down at us at all, but you look very powerful.
Ooh, like that.
Oh, you must know, but you must know that.
Huh, I don't know.
Well, look at on Pizza Mind. So the clips I have seen that are available on YouTube and all the rest of it, you are in front of a beautiful theatre.
Yeah.
Like, the decisions were made there, right?
Like, totally.
It's a beautiful red curtain. You are, I never know how to describe clothes. Is it like a gown?
It's a jumpsuit.
You know, but you look incredibly elegant and elevated, kind of heightened. You look like you could be about to do a cello recital. Do you know what I mean? And those are decisions, right? So,
so
talk to me about those decisions. What does that mean to you to have that? I understand what you're saying about you want it to be conversational. You want it to not appear like shtick.
Mm-hmm.
But what else is going on there?
Yeah, I guess that is interesting because I do want my vibe to be casual, but I'm very aware this is a show. So when I make decisions of like, I'm going to wear a beautiful blue jumpsuit and we're going to be in a beautiful stage and have a wonderful curtain that like makes my skin look good. These are all things where it's like, I'm thinking about this and also thinking about how people are viewing it. I don't love the like, I just rolled out of bed and came on stage kind of attitude, even though I am trying to create a casual vibe.
Yes.
So I don't know. I guess I haven't thought about it that much, but I do want people to feel like, wow, I got a full show out of there. But I also felt really comfortable,
yes.
You know? And I feel like I was being talked at. I felt like I was being talked to.
Yes, that's definitely true. So do you remember what bit are you opening with? Is it the same set list every night at the moment? Oh, has it been
this week, I think I maybe added a couple things throughout the week and rearranged some stuff, but I definitely started the same way every night.
So I've seen about 30 comedians this week, so please indulge me. Can you remind me what was your opening?
Well, my opening bit is a new one, like really new. Talking about this camping trip that I went on with my boyfriend.
Yes, taking psychedelics.
Yes.
On there, yes.
Yeah. And my acid trip and listening to the animals and whatnot. And that the camping trip was like 2 or 3 weeks ago. So this
really?
Okay. Yeah. So this was just truly a new bit that I was like, that's fun. And I did it a few times in New York and I was like, great, I'll just start with that. And that for me makes the set feel fresh because I'm like already excited about this new bit. And then, it kind of rolls into the other stuff I already have.
Okay. And the crux of that routine is that you are having, you know, a profound moment about your place in the universe.
Yeah.
And then you're aware that you're going to continue having this profound moment for ages while the acid went
off. Yeah. Yeah. I was having too long of a revelation.
Yeah, that's a really... I've never heard anyone describe that stuff on stage before. You know, that, you know, I'm kind of... It's an interesting topic, I suppose, because in, like, if someone said to me, oh, she's got this really great routine about being on acid, like, that does not do it justice at all. But we've all seen a bunch of, like, no, it's, I was on acid and crazy stuff happened. And it's sort of similar, I suppose, in tone to the way that, say, 10 years ago, women couldn't make jokes about menstruation on stage. Uh-huh. Certainly in the UK. I mean, you could, but you would be pilloried by other women as well as other men. And, you know, we don't want to hear about that. And that has really moved on, that you could kind of go, oh, no, we can absolutely talk about menstruating now.
Yeah.
I wonder if there is a particular... I wonder if the approach is somehow analogous, that your bit about taking psychedelic drugs is nothing like the stereotype of kind of a...
I'd hope so, yeah. We actually kind of just had a thing about women talking about their lady parts and whatnot. Like, a female comedian, I guess, kind of made disparaging remarks about other female comics who choose to talk about their vagina all the time.
Okay.
And quote all the time.
Yeah, right.
And then some other comedians, like Sarah Schaefer, created this like fundraiser for Planned Parenthood that also had 50 female comedians talking about their vagina.
I don't think I've seen Sarah Schaefer's act, but I think she's a blogger as well. Did she write something?
She's a writer. She used to write for Fallon and had her own show with Nikki Glaser. Gotcha. And yeah, she's great. But yeah, I thought it was really funny that she, and they did this show in the West Coast in LA and the East Coast in New York. And I did the New York one. Okay. And so it truly was 50 women talking about their vagina and just like, you know, anything about it. Could be like sex, could be, you know, periods, like however you view that, childbirth. And I was really, really impressed with how many different versions of jokes there were and how different styles and
were you
like
once, were you in that lineup? Were you
yeah, I was. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I actually told the, I don't know if you remember, but I had a joke about this, like when I thought I had an STD and
yes,
and going to Planned Parenthood and getting checked out and whatnot. And so I told that. But yeah, it was so cool to hear, like, none of these jokes are like a typical vagina joke. It's like, yeah, no, you can actually have many.
Because what is
many.
A typical vagina joke in inverted commas? Well, that's just any joke.
It's just a joke.
Reference to a vagina that probably a man has listened to and thought, oh, God, this again.
Yeah, and it's like, that shouldn't be the reaction. This is a thing. This is a part of us. This is a part of our body that exists and we shouldn't ignore it. Also, it births people. Like, you came out of a vagina, why are you grossed out about hearing about it? So yeah, I'm hoping that is changing. And then yeah, same thing with drugs. I think it, when you hear someone saying like, I was on this trip, and I understand that when people describe trips, if you aren't on that drug as well, or if you've never done it before, it might be kind of lame to hear it. So I was trying to describe it in a way that you could understand it. I think people can understand being trapped in something for longer than they want. So the idea of like,
yeah, absolutely.
I was high for 4 or 5 hours and I didn't want to be anymore. And, yeah, just describing how I wanted to like be over it. I was so done.
And with that, if that actual event happened only 2 or 3 weeks ago, what was the first, was that the first time on Monday when you talked about it on stage, or had you done some work on that?
I had worked on it, yeah.
Can you tell us what that work was? I'm sorry, I interrupted you telling us what that work was.
Oh, that's okay. I have a monthly show in Brooklyn called Sashir's Made a Party Time, and it's a variety show, and I host it. And so at the top, I kind of recount what I'm going through. I just like talk to the audience mostly, but I might sprinkle some established bits in there, but it's kind of a time for me to figure out new stuff.
Okay.
So that show was, I think, the day I got back from that camping trip. So it was already on the brain and I was just talking about it, and I record every set. And so I like listened back and tried to figure out which points people were actually laughing at. And,
okay.
And then, had a few more shows after that and tried to like whittle it down to the parts that were getting the most laughs and that I thought were the most important.
That's which aren't necessarily the same parts, because that, I think that's a decision what we all make as comedians, is the degree to which we're led by their response and the degree to which we're led by what we want to say.
Correct. Yeah. Cause there's some things where it's like, no one's laughing at this, but I think it's essential to the joke for you to understand the rest of it. or people are laughing at this part, but I'm like, that's actually a lame part. Like, I don't really need that part.
And well done to you for the quality control to throw out a bit that works.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
We all have some kind of like, I just keep doing that bit and I probably shouldn't.
I know. Yeah. I've had people be like, oh, what about this joke that you used to do? That used to hit hard. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't feel like it represents me anymore. Or like,
can you give us an example of a bit like that?
Yeah. I used to talk about sex a lot on stage, and just cause I thought it was funny. And then after a while I was like, huh, this doesn't feel like it really represents me. I mean, I do have sex, but I also was trying to be wary of like how people in the audience perceive me. Like, I didn't want them to think like, wow, she fucks all the time. Like, or even if they did think that, who cares? But I didn't want people to leave the show thinking that's all I had to say. I actually gave myself a challenge and I was like, I'm going to try to write jokes that have nothing to do with sex. And then I opened up a whole new world of other things that I wanted to say. But yeah, there was like a joke about how many white guys I've slept with. And it was like, I started telling it like a Def Jam comic. And it would be like, I've been with so many white boys that, and then I think I made it was a call and response. This is an old joke. So it's truly trying to, it's coming back to me, but it's like,
this is a safe space for you to admit your old joke.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been with so many white boys, you can open up a cupcake shop down there. Or like a Panera. I just like listed a bunch of white things. Panera Bread, a Hale and Hearty. I've been with so many white boys that... Or no, so many white boys been beating up this pussy that you could call it Rodney King. And then people will be like, ugh. And I'm like, we need to talk about this. And force people to like be okay with it.
And was that hard to let go of that bit once you...
It was a really good bit. People loved it. And it's like very performative. Like I was, you know, it was a new energy on stage. But then I wrote other stuff that I loved. So I was like, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess it's hard as in like, that was good. But then if I tried to do it now, it would feel so... fake. Like, I try to do old bits where I'm like, it was good, let me see, but then it's like I'm writing things that are personal to me in that moment, so I'm evolving, I'm changing as a person, so like this joke that I wrote in 2013 doesn't apply to me now,
yeah,
because I've changed and I don't think the same things. So yeah, I've there's a lot of jokes that have gone away because I don't believe in them anymore.
Are there any parts of your, let me ask you this, of your current material, either new or old, but the stuff that you've been doing here in Montreal, what is the routine that you think is most representative of the comic that you are or the comic that you want to be?
Probably my closer, which was the resting rape face bit.
yeah.
Where I talk about how I hate the term resting bitch face and describe why my face is resting, because it's just fucking tired of being told to smile, of waiting for my turn to speak when I'm in a room full of men, and for apologizing for things that I'm not actually sorry for. And that's a thing that women have to deal with all the time, just in general. So it's like, no, there's no question why my face is tired. and then I counter it to this guy I'm talking to in the joke and saying like, oh, it's so funny that you say that, I have a resting bitch face. This whole time you've had a resting rape face. And there's actually a clip of this online right now. And the comment section is wild.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of dudes being like, oh, men have resting bitch faces too. And this is a bunch of just social justice warrior bullshit. And then, like,
yeah.
It's so funny where it's like, all I'm doing is saying why I think that I have a regular face. This makes people mad. This makes men mad. And probably some women too, who don't realize that they don't have to be mad about this stuff. But I think that's probably in the direction where I'm going, where it's like, I don't know, just giving less fucks and talking about how proud I am to be who I am. And I am a black person. I'm a woman. I'm a black woman. I live in America. And yeah, I'm just proud of the stuff I got. And I'm tired of people telling me not to be. So the more things I write, the more things that come up are that are like protecting that, I guess.
So this is Sashia, really invigorating. I maybe overuse the word invigorating, but it is, you know, that's it was fun, interesting, entertaining, and really whatever the other component of invigorating is. I came away from this interview thinking, Jesus, I've got to do more. I've got to be more. So more on from Sashia in just a second. We talk about life coaching. We talk about various other aspects of her life, her comedy life and her practice. And we will get back to that in just a second. Those of you who are yet to buy tickets, who live in Belfast and are yet to buy tickets for the upcoming live ComCom with Tim McGarry, you can do so by putting Tim McGarry, Comedians Comedian Podcast, Belfast Comedy Festival into the search engine of your choice. I don't have a link in front of me, and even if I did, I mean, you can't read out links, can you? Slashes and .coms and so on. But do come along to see that. Tim McGarry is a tremendously fun person to talk to and knows the Belfast comedy scene inside out. So that will be a really good live one. Tomorrow, I'm recording this on Saturday the 16th, and tomorrow, Sunday the 17th, by the time you hear this, will already have elapsed. We will already have recorded a live podcast with Michael Legg as part of the Objectively Funny Comedy Festival. So I hope lots of you are coming along to that. I hope a lot of you will have had come along. Wasn't there a thing in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where Douglas Adams was talking about the new tenses that had to be created to cope with time travel? Something like that. Recording something in the present, referring back to a thing that I hope in the present you will have done in what is now the past. I mean, we're all on the same page here. I don't need to bang on about it. Thank you to those of you donating to the show. Lots of people are still very kindly donating with their recurring subscriptions. The one-off donations have really tailed off, everybody. And that's fine. I know not all of you can afford to support the show. And I know many of you support the show in other ways. But it occurs to me maybe as a result of the Edinburgh Festival and so many of you blowing all of your money on travelling to Edinburgh, living in Edinburgh and seeing loads of shows up there. So all of those things are excellent uses of your performative dollar. But if you would like to support this podcast, then you can join the patreon.com/comcompod if you're a bleeding edge techno kid, or if you have a PayPal account, you can make a recurring payment of 1, 2, 5, or 10 pounds at comedianscomedian.com/donate, or you can just drop a nice fat juicy donation right on my head at that same web address in a one-off kind of way. And if you don't have a PayPal account, you can support the show via Moonclerk, whatever that is. So thank you to those of you who are continuing to do so, and for those of you who are thinking, do you know, I'd always planned to donate to ComCom, but I never get round to it. I've never got my wallet when I'm listening. I'm always running. I'm in the bath. I don't have access to the internet. Well, come on, these days you can do it all on your phone. So as someone who's recently converted, did I mention this? On the first day of the Edinburgh Festival, I converted from iPhone to Android, and not only has that opened up a whole new world of confusingly non industry standard podcast apps, but it also was really horrific timing when you don't know how to make your notifications work. It's opened a whole new world of getting things done, or the ability to get things done, and more importantly, the ability to find more interesting ways to not get things done whilst appearing or convincing yourself that you are doing that. So my point is, by now, as you listen to this, unless you're driving, you can always just take a brief pause and go, do you know what? Why don't I make today the day I get around to supporting the Comedians Comedian Podcast? That's fair, isn't it? I mean, I think I've shown my hand early there by pointing out that, yeah, the donations have dropped off a little. Maybe I could have said all of this without needing to point that out. But I think at the end of the day, you know exactly. Each of you individually knows how much or how little. Maybe some of you treat this podcast as not a weighty thing at all. Maybe it's a bit of conversational froth, just from a slightly different angle to the other available conversational froth. But either way, if you're enjoying the show, then and you're in a position to support the show, then you do that for all the people who enjoy it but are not in that position. So thank you very much. Enough said about that. You can email me info@comedianscomedian.com. You can tweet me @comcompod, as you well know. know. And you can remember to subscribe to the mailing list, because I'm going to drop, that's what I say instead of release these days. I'm going to drop everyone's a comedian. Everyone's on a comedian. Jesus, they are. Some of the scurrilous young comics I've just been chatting to about their experience of the Edinburgh Festival are to be believed. Everyone is on and under a comedian. But everyone is a comedian. That will be coming to you soon. And remember, the T-shirt post sale, your last chance to get hold of one of the glorious Polly Becker designed original Thanks Man ComCom T-shirts. That is going to run throughout October. So you can go to, well, it's not October yet, so I'm not going to tell you where to go. But keep your ears peeled for that. I will chat to you a little more after we return to this conversation with Sashir Zamar.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you say you're tired of people telling you not to be... Do you mean you're tired of people telling you not to be that kind of comic or not to talk about those kind of things on stage?
Thankfully, no one who matters is telling me that. You know, I've never had a boss or anyone who wrote my checks out or like a manager representation tell me like, maybe you should try this kind of style because that would suck. But... you know, there's tons of trolls or people in the audience that are like, you should be louder or like run around or like, you know, like if there's a heckler, you should attack them or what, you know, people have like different understanding of what comedy should be. And especially if you're a woman, I've had people come up to me after shows and give me advice. And I'm like, why do you, Joe Schmo, like you have never been on stage before. Why do you think that you have an idea of what I should be doing on stage? I'm the one getting paid for the show. You paid for the show. but I think some people, mostly men, can't comprehend a woman doing something they can't do or doing it better than them.
Yes. So doing something not only that they can't do, but that they're scared of, mm-hmm. that they love to do, but they're scared of.
Yeah.
So it's like an attempt to kind of appropriate or kind of to take some sort of ownership.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, occasionally men will, almost no women, but occasionally men will say that to me, but it's very occasional.
Yeah.
And you do, I clearly get a sense that like, yeah, you want to be doing this. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I am, of course, far less the subject of, I mean, there's one particular video that is connected with this podcast, which had 250,000 views, and it was to do with I never know what it, this is interesting, I don't know whether I want to talk about it on this episode because it's just going to fucking fire up the whole thing again. Loads of MRAs jumped on this thing.
Oh wow.
And but it's the only time I've had to put up with it.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about privilege, having an argument with Bill Burr about whether or not privilege is a thing.
Oh wow.
And 9 minutes of it was clipped and put on this MRA website under the title Bill Burr Destroys Male Feminist. And 250,000 people stopped by to call me a cuck fag. and then started to discover my other videos, which none of which, you know, stand-up videos. I'm not a political stand-up. I don't have much, any feminist material.
Yeah.
I'll occasionally refer to, you know, I'll try and frame things in such a way that I'm not being lazy. I'm trying to be as kind of on it as possible. And I will get, oh, suddenly since that happened, now I'm getting a lot of hate. Like, here's a routine about, you know, a sword, and someone's like, yeah, a whining cuck fag, and you're like, well, you're clearly, this is a reference to something else. Now, for me, that's the irony in that, is that they're arguing that privilege isn't a thing, and the fact that they're attacking me once only for this thing is like, oh, that's, yeah, because I am the beneficiary of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't give a shit the rest of the time, because I'm a white man.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Which kind of undermines their theory. But anyway, do you, how are your kind of emotional defenses against that sort of thing, given that you're in the territory of being, I don't know if outspoken is the right word, just kind of firm, confident, and talking about, you know, your race and your gender? To what extent do you cope emotionally with being attacked?
I'm glad you said not outspoken, because sometimes people are like, wow, you're so like,
yeah,
brave for like speaking out for women or for black people or whatever. And I'm like, I'm literally just talking about my personal experiences. I'm not like trying to lead a revolution, but I mean, I will, but I'm glad people are learning things and hearing a new perspective on things. But yeah, it's like, this is all familiar territory to me. It's not me like, you know, truly learning things and teaching them to people. It's like, this is normal stuff. I guess it doesn't get spoken enough. That's why it's brave. But for trolls, again, they don't pay me, so I don't give a shit.
That is a refreshingly direct approach.
Truly. I mean, like, if you, unless it was like all my audience who were paying for my shows, if they're upset, then I would reevaluate what I'm doing and being like, oh, I guess my fan base is, I've disconnected in some way. But if it's like these trolls who just like see 2 minutes of me on YouTube or like hear me on a interview or something, and they don't know anything that I'm talking about or just know me personally or anything, that I don't really care.
Have you ever cared? Is that a skin you've had to grow, or is that just like this never?
Yeah, I think so. I don't remember it ever really affecting me. It's just kind of like, oh, people will always hate. Even if I have the best joke ever, someone's going to be like, I can pick apart why that's wrong. I can find something and find a reason why it offends this group, or like why it offends me, or, you know, she looks like a whore in this video. You know, like, it doesn't matter. They'll find something wrong with it just because I exist and I'm speaking, and I can't get bogged down with that, because that's not helping me. That's not giving me any like added like experience or education, or it's unnecessary. Also, it's like I personally have never disliked something and then felt like I needed to type it out. I just like, oh, I dislike it. And then I've also never felt like if I loved something that I would type it out either. So this is a different mindset that I don't understand. These are people that we're not on the same wavelength. So if you're the type of person who's like, I dislike this, and then your reaction is to spend time out of your day to tell somebody about it, then that's on you.
It's almost the covert nature of it is fascinating, because like, I don't spend any time particularly, I certainly don't slag anything off online. I spend very little time bigging things up unless I'm like particularly blown away by something. And I think that's probably true of a lot of my friends, but you don't know who's doing it because it's all anonymized. And I would love to be able, or maybe I would, maybe this would be a terrible idea, but if you were able somehow to, if there was a visual representation, like if some people walking around were just like bright purple and you go, oh, that's because they, you know, then we could at least gauge how many people it is.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the frightening things about online abuse is you've no idea what proportion of the public does this represent.
Yeah, it's true. But, and people also don't think about their actions when they're online. Like, if you are a person who is inclined to say negative things all the time. Like, I've had some people tweet things at me, and, you know, depending on my mood, I might like it. I might just, like, favorite it. Like,
that's beautifully passive-aggressive.
Just, like, I won't respond. I'll just, like, I saw it. And then a few people have been like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't really mean it. You're actually really funny. Or like, they'll backtrack because they thought I would never see this.
Okay.
They think I'm a brand or a company or like that. Maybe someone else is handling my social media or something. They don't know that I'm scrolling through it every night. And
every night's quite telling.
Because I get bored.
Yeah.
But I'm not like looking for shit, but if some things pop up, I'm like, oh, okay. And yeah, depending on if I want to do something, I might like it. But yeah, there was like some guy who was tweeting at me a lot and just like stupid stuff. Like it wasn't specific to like, you're not funny, or this joke was bad. It was just like race stuff or just like whatever the base, insult could be. And I looked at his account and it was created like a day or two ago and it was, and with a fake picture. And I was like, oh, you are a troll. Mm-hmm. You are definitely just trying to make people upset. And then I looked at his tweets and he was just tweeting all sorts of celebrities saying the same stuff. Mm. And I was like, well, then I don't care. Mm. If that's what you get, like if that's the enjoyment you get out of life, then go for it. But to me, it's like, oh, then you clearly don't care about me because you're tweeting everybody.
How long have you been performing?
Since I was like 9. I've been in gospel choir and my church and then show choir in high school and musicals.
And whereabouts are we talking? I don't know where you're from.
I'm from Indiana.
Okay.
Indianapolis, Indiana. And I was in my church choir and then I auditioned for an improv team in my high school and I made it, but then the rehearsals interfered with my show choir rehearsals, so I quit. But then I did improv in college and really loved it. And then the touring company for UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, came to my college. I saw them and I was like, I gotta go wherever they're from. And then moved to New York. But I majored in drama, so I thought I was gonna be in Broadway and like I was auditioning for all these plays.
But did you want to be? Or was it like that was the only version of being a performer that you thought was available?
I guess that's the option I thought was available. Because looking back, I mean, I love theater and I appreciate the art form, but I didn't love that grind. That wasn't for me. Like getting up really early and waiting hours and hours to be seen. And they treat you differently when you have a SAG card and when you don't. So I didn't have a SAG card yet.
Okay.
Your union card. Because you have to, like, audition a certain amount of times and be in a certain amount of plays. And there's, like, so many rules. And I was like, I just want to get on stage right now. And I would go to UCB and watch shows. And you could. I mean, you couldn't get on immediately, but you could, like, take classes and then have a practice group. And then your group could start a show at a bar somewhere. And then you could just, like, perform whenever, and you'd have to rehearse. I mean, we had practices, but you know, I liked the aspect of how everything was new.
Yes,
you could just create it, and then that was the only time that show happened. And then the next time you come, it's a totally different show.
And how old were you when you were at college and you first encountered UCB?
I guess 21.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting that they kind of rolled into town. It's a bit like running away with a circus.
Oh, yeah.
You said I want to go wherever they're going.
I guess that's what happened, yeah. They took me.
So you then went on to work with UCB?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took improv classes and then sketch classes. And then shortly after that, started doing open mics for stand-up. And it was just like kept doing all of it at the same time.
And were you one of their, like, I don't know too much about UCB, but I would guess in any group of people who are all hungry to do a thing, there's particular characters, there's particular stars, the people who tend to do the best. Were you one of them or were you?
After a while, yeah.
Yeah, nicely put.
At first, you know, I was like a student like everybody else, but then I failed my 401 class. Like they have improv 101, 201, 301, 401. You're supposed to pass your 401. And then, if you pass, there's like advanced study. And then, and also you need to pass your 401 in order to audition for a house team.
Okay.
And why
did you fail?
I failed 401 and the notes were like, I mean, at the time I was like, I did not deserve to fail. And I can't remember what my notes were, but I felt like the teacher maybe was checked out, but it truly doesn't matter. But now I'm thankful that I failed because that made me pause in my curriculum. I just stopped taking classes for like a few months, like half a year, really, and then formed my own improv group because I was like, I'm just going to perform. I don't need to take these classes to do that. I'm going to find my own group, perform the way I want, because the notes I would get sometimes would be like, you need to be bigger or louder or more crazy, have crazier characters. But I like being a straight man. Like, I like being, or a straight person. and I like wrangling the crazy rather than creating the crazy. And in my, I had a 3-person group called Doppelganger, which was me, Nicole Byer, and Keisha Zoller. 3 black ladies, which was like unheard of at the time. And we kind of took over. We were killing it. We were doing our own little indie shows. And then there was a competition, where the teams, 2 teams would compete and the audience would vote who would keep going to the next week. And we won a lot. And we were beating some of our teachers. And it was a really...
So you can have an honorary 401 pass. Is that the...
Yeah, I actually beat my teacher who was teaching my second 401 while I was in class. But yeah, I guess that's kind of how most things in my life go, where I get rejection in something and then I go create my own thing and then it turns out to be better for me anyway.
Yes. Why was Doppelganger so successful?
I think our chemistry was amazing. Like, we all play very differently. Like, Nicole's very in the moment, and she's kind of like a bull in a china shop. She'll just, like, drop any kind of move, and then everyone else has to deal with it. Like, I think in the future, like, okay, how can we use what's going on later? And then Keisha thinks in the past, where she's like, what did we do 5 moves ago, and how can we bring it back? So it's really a nice, like, puzzle that we've created where everyone's working on a different thing. And it's like, I'm so thankful Keisha's there, because it's like, oh, thank gosh you remember that thing that we did 10 minutes ago, because I would have forgot. And, you know, thank God Nicole created this crazy move so that we could, like, propel the scene. And then I'm trying to wrap it up in a bow. And, yeah, it's just always so fun.
And what was the kind of the creative dynamic between you? Was there a sort of a friendly competition, or was it all that you were working...
At that time, definitely working together. And then and we got so much attention. And the AD at the time, Anthony King, told SNL about us. And because he was like, there are these 3 funny ladies here and you should look at them. And so a producer came, watched our show, told us to submit. And then that was like, you know, great for all of us, but does create some tension because we're all now competing.
Yeah.
For one role. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
as I understand it, one ethnically diverse woman since forever. this is the one place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there was no, A, that's problematic in its own way, and also there's no question that they're going to go, oh, we'll take 2 of you or all 3 of you.
Yeah. I mean, they could have. I wish they did, but they didn't. So, we all auditioned for years. Like, this was maybe like 2011. I can't really remember. But we like submitted tapes and writing packets. And then there would be showcases where you do your 5 minutes in front of an audience and in front of the producers and Lorne. And then if they like that, then they bring you in to test. And so Nicole tested a year before I did, and they liked her a lot. And then, but she didn't get it. And then the next year is when they had that push for diversity. And me and Nicole were both doing showcases. And she already lived in LA at this time. And so she did the LA showcase. I did the New York showcase. And then I was the only one who got called. I mean, you know, of my friends got called in for a test. And then I got cast. But that, you know, I would be lying if I said that that was an easy thing for us, for our friendship. Because everyone wants that job. Mm. If you do comedy. I mean, not everyone, but most people do want a chance to do that job. And we're great now, but it took a lot of personal growth for both of us and a lot of adult conversations for us to be okay with still working together, but understanding we're just now we're doing different things and that's okay.
Did you have to let her know that you got it?
I did. She was the third person I called. I called my mom, my dad, and then her. And, yeah, it took her a while to be really happy for me. But
and through that time, how did you feel?
So shitty. I felt like I couldn't talk to her. I felt like I couldn't tell her things that were happening in the office or, like, cool things that happened or bad things that happened because it felt like I was bragging because, you know, she wanted this.
Yeah.
So...
And was there one particular... You said there was a lot of kind of adult conversations. Was there a particular way of phrasing it or a way of you framing it between you that you kind of went, that's it, dealt with now?
I don't know. I don't think there was a moment where it's like, ugh, got that taken yeah, care of. Sure. Like I said, it was a lot of conversations, a lot of drunk in the rain conversations or late night phone calls where, you know, we're talking about how we really feel. And this is also not even the first time we encountered this. Cause like when we were younger in the industry, there's a show called Girl Code that Nicole auditioned for, got it, but I didn't even get a chance to audition for it. And so when she told me, my first response was, oh, well, why didn't I audition for that? Instead of congratulations. So it's like, we both do it to each other and this will continue to happen probably for the rest of our careers. Cause we are two funny black women and until we get to a point where we all get so many chances and there's not just like a certain number for us, then we will compete with each other.
I did an interview recently with a British comic and improviser called Pippa Evans, where she told a similar story about the nature of dealing with professional jealousy between female friends. And it struck me then, as it strikes me more deeply now, that I've never heard a man tell a version of that story. I've never heard a guy go, so me and my friend, we were at risk of falling out, so we really talked about it and had some mature conversations. I mean, the idea is sort of risible. What a shame.
I know. Because it's like, yeah, you'll probably just find another opportunity.
Yeah.
But yeah, for women, and I think also, especially women of color, we're like very aware that there's probably only so many chances for us. So it's like, well, if you got that, they're not looking for another one, which is so silly. But I do think it's changing and it's getting better. I think shows and producers and studios are seeing that people want to see more voices and more just options. And so hopefully it'll get better. But, you know, right now...
I was saying before, having not really been an expert on SNL and only getting into it recently, probably in the UK, a lot of people, a lot of comedy super fans in the UK, a lot of comedians have been into SNL. It's not something that had been on my radar. It's not something that had been on my radar as much as I feel it should. I feel like, oh God, where do I start? You know, there's so much. But one of the things, obviously, that it has really hit off is all the Trump, you know, Baldwin doing Trump. And via that, I then, only in researching you yesterday, did I go, oh, you were Keely on Black Jeopardy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay, well, that I saw, you know, because I got into trouble and I just ended up watching loads and loads and loads of Black Jeopardy.
Which yeah, that's a fantastic. Great sketch, right?
So, in my kind of very naive understanding of how the show works, were you writing on Black Jeopardy?
No. Brian Tucker and Michael Che wrote those Black Jeopardy sketches.
Okay.
And then the performers can pitch lines if they want. So there's probably a couple jokes that I pitched, but no, I didn't. Okay. I didn't really help write the sketch.
Okay. Okay. And how does that feel? What are the, as a writer performer yourself, how do you cope, sort of suggest, I don't mean to suggest anything negative about it, but obviously if you are pitching an idea for a joke and they go, no, you're fine. Just say our words. How's that? Is it frustrating or is it just, are you kind of going, I'm so pleased to be here?
It can be frustrating, but you know, after I was there 4 years. So part of me was like used to it. It was like, oh, whatever. Like all your good ideas go in the trash at the end of the week. even if it went on air, it's like, now we're done. And then we have to reset and then start over again. So it really taught me how to kill your darlings and not be too attached to an idea. Cause it could be, we could have a good idea up until the show starts, up until the sketch. And then for some reason we're running out of time and then we have to cut lines. And then it's like, whatever. For the good of the show, we have to pare things down and change things and you know, maybe like legal says that we can't say this thing now or whatever, or this advertiser for some reason doesn't like this topic. There's so many things that go into that show that I don't even know about that dictate how we execute what we do. So yeah, by the end, I was like, whatever.
Yeah. That's interesting, that idea of the good of the, for the good of the show. Presumably the good of the show doesn't, like someone's idea, like the steering hand of the show, their idea of the good of the show doesn't necessarily tally with your idea of what's best for the show.
Yeah, that can happen. And that's, there's nothing, I'm not the boss, so there's nothing I can really do about that.
Yeah, yeah. Go and make your own show.
Exactly, yeah. Also, not everyone came knowing each other. Like, this is kind of a smattering of people who have different writing styles, have different performing styles, and we're just told to, like, make it work. And that works all the time. But also, it's like, you know, it'd be easier if it's, like, you and your buddies getting together. And,
yeah. I suppose one of the most valuable qualities as an SNL staffer, is that the right word? Team member?
Yeah.
Cast member?
Yeah, writer. Cast member and then writers.
One of the most valuable qualities must be the flexibility to be able to work with other people's sense of humor and other people's working style.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I feel like I came away with a better understanding of how to communicate my ideas to people who may not understand them right off the bat. And then also collaborating with different people who have different styles and humor. And yeah, I learned a shit ton. And it was so valuable. That's stuff you can't pay for because you're just getting thrown in there and they're like, make something. and you have to, because we only have 5 more days until the show.
And can you give us an example of like one of the lessons that you took away from that?
Nothing specifically I want to say.
Yeah, okay, well, that's fine. Or maybe a preconception you had going in that was disproved.
I guess I don't know if this was a preconception, but I was surprised to see, like, how, like, what writing night is. We write everything in one night on Tuesday. And you kind of just find your tribe. You kind of just find people who you jive with and then write together. But it's not like an open room where we're pitching ideas to get together and, like, saying, like, okay, you write that, you write that. There's no real, like, communication throughout the whole floor. It's just like,
okay,
kind of a lot of closed doors and people being like, okay, well, I'm writing this with this person and then I'm writing this with this person, and then you have to like find those people. So, and I started mid-season, so I had no idea who my people were.
So it's a lot less like the kind of big table in 30 Rock.
Yeah, it's very much individual offices.
And then when you get to the... I remember I spoke to Hannibal Buress on the show, and he was talking about putting the script up on an OHP and beating the jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to, like... that happens throughout the whole week. People will, like, give punch-ups, and then there's, like, you're rewriting the sketches and then punching up the jokes, because it might be funny during a read-through, but we can make it funnier.
What lessons stick in your mind as things that you managed to take with you into your stand-up? Like, did you have time to be doing stand-up whilst you were doing that?
I did do stand-up while I was doing it, which was, I was so happy to do that. Because, like, if I had a bad week, I could go on stage and just, like...
Agency!
Yeah. Like, I know what I'm doing. Yeah. Or even if I had a good week. But it was just nice to be able to go on stage and just say whatever I wanted and have an immediate reaction from the audience instead of creating something. Maybe no one read it, or maybe we did read it, we didn't pick it. And then I'm just like, you know, kind of waiting around for the rest of the week. But I'm trying to think of a lesson. I don't know. I guess I just learned like how to stand up for what I wanted, or like the things that were important to me. And I didn't always win, but I at least left feeling super confident and knowing what I want. Where I think when I showed up, I was just happy to be there. And I was like, I'm ready to go. I'll do whatever you say. And I was trying to like fit into the mold of the show. And then by the time I left, I was like, no, I know my mold. I know what I like and what I want. And I don't think that I have to try to plug myself into this thing. If that doesn't feel right.
So did you, how does it work when you're leaving the show? Did you decide to leave to focus on your stand-up?
I decided to leave, yeah, and to focus on whatever I want. But yeah, yeah. Stand-up, acting, writing.
Sorry, my preoccupation is always stand-up. I think so.
Totally, yeah, yeah.
A lot of other strings to your bow. But so was that a hard decision to make, or were you ready to go?
I was ready to go. But that doesn't mean that wasn't a hard decision. It's like breaking up with somebody. You know, like you might feel like this needs to end, but that doesn't mean the love's gone. Still love that show. I'll still watch that show. But I, you know, thought about it for a long time and had many, many conversations with the people who work there about it and decided it was time to go.
And then how soon was it, like when you walked out the door, like the last time you left, what was the very next thing that you did creatively? Was that your own stand-up, or was it like to take a break from it all? Or
I think maybe I didn't get on stage for a week or something. And then getting on stage after that was weird, because I was like, do I talk about it? Do I, like,
yeah.
Does everyone know? It's so hard to know what people know about the show or what they don't know, because it feels like sometimes everyone's talking about what's going on with SNL. And then sometimes I talk to people and they're like, oh, I don't really watch it. Or
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. I don't pay attention much, and yeah. Which is great.
It's like talking to family members almost. You go, oh, you know, name of huge comic said this or done that. And they're like, I've never heard of them. And you're like, oh, yeah, it's sort of only really massively important in my head.
Yeah, totally. Which is nice.
Yes. Yes. So you, how long are we talking? Whenabouts did you leave?
The finale, I think, was May 20th. And that was the last time.
May just gone.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a huge hole in my research. I'm sorry, I didn't realize.
Oh, it's okay.
Just, I having read about it, I didn't, wasn't following the dates. And when was Pizza Mind released?
March 30th. So okay. Within the season.
So that was released before.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah.
And as a boring technical question, tell me about the decision to put the special on CISO, because that's not something that I'd heard of before, that
yeah.
platform. Is that a well-known platform? Were you like a kind of spearhead for their...
Kind of, yeah. It's new. So it's owned by NBC Universal. So it's okay. Kind of in the NBC family. And they were just really excited about me and what I had going on. And they were also like, let me be in control of a lot of stuff. They okay. They let me, you know, creatively have a lot of input in what was going on. So I felt like that was really important for me, and I don't know if that would have happened somewhere else, because that was my first special. So I being somewhere else, they may be like, oh, you can't do this, or that's cute, but we don't want to do that. And you know, CISO was very hands off, and they're like, we support you, we want you to do well, we want it to be good, and in your voice. So,
and that seems like a good fit for the sort of performer you are.
Yeah definitely.
So what's next?
What's next? More stand-up and TV and movie stuff. I booked two movies. I'm going to shoot them in August, September. Which
Can
is,
you tell us what the movies are?
One is a indie drama called Ghetto Plainsman. And it's about a gay man in the 80s, 90s who's trying to like find himself. And I'm his best friend, who's an actress in New York. So, you know, real stretch for me. And I'm in an Amy Schumer comedy, and I'm still in talks of other projects too. So,
okay,
yeah.
And are you feeling? I mean, it's like are you feeling kind of world at your feet at the moment?
A little bit, yeah, yeah. People are really excited for me, and excited that I'm available and that I can do more of my own work, and I'm excited to give it to them.
So what are, to wrap up then, what are some of the, like, I feel like you're incredibly confident, intelligent, skilled. Do you know what I mean? You're just like, yep, I've got this. Are there any chinks in your armor?
Oh, well, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I can't think of it off the top of my head because I'm so confident and strong and intelligent. Yeah.
But like, are you, I'm interested in, I suppose, if I were listening to this interview, like, you know, sort of separate to it, I'd kind of go, I think I'm really pleased for you. This is all very well. How do I get to be more like this? Or what sorts of, either how can I be more like this, or what sort, like, let me know that you struggle as well.
Oh, sure. Fine. I'll let you know that I struggle if I must. I guess I just got okay with rejection. I got a lot of no's before I started getting yeses. I'm still getting no's. And I probably will continue to get no's as I keep going in my career. So just realizing that the no's don't mean that I'm bad. It just means that wasn't a good fit. And I just got to keep going and finding where I fit in and where I feel most comfortable and where my voice can flourish the most. And then it will be great. And I guess I'm so confident in what I have to say and what I want that when someone doesn't want what I got, I'm like, that's their loss. Where before it would have been like, oh, they don't want me. Okay, that means I need to change, or like that means that I should probably be better at X, Y, and Z. And if I don't care about X, Y, and Z, why am I trying to get better at that? So I need to just focus on like what actually makes me happy and makes me feel fulfilled artistically. And if someone gets it, then I'll keep them, you know, I'll keep that working relationship. If they don't, then it doesn't matter to me. You don't need to be here.
And is that approach learned? And if it is learned, is it purely learned from the choices you've made in your career and how people have treated you? Or are you like, that seems like such good software, like mental software. Have you read self-help books about it? Have you been on a personal development course? You have.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm so into like personal development and learning about yourself and self-care and stuff. The Artist's Way helped me a lot by Julia Cameron. It's like a 12-week workbook where you take yourself on artist dates, you journal, you just try to figure out your goals, and then have a better way to approach it afterwards. And I also have a life coach, and I took her. She has a class that was kind of like time management for artists that I took like in 2012 or something. And I remember at the end of the class, I was crying because I didn't want it to end. I thought it was so helpful. And we thought about our goals for the next year. So it was like, July 29th of 2018, I want to have written and produced a movie. I want to have toured to these different countries I've never been to. I want to have booked these commercials or whatever the things are. And then you work backwards and you go, okay, so if I have to do that 9 months from now, these things need to happen. And then 6 months from now, these things need to happen. You just work backwards, even to the week. And it seems so simple, but it's like, you won't do it. You need someone to tell you to do it. So having that structure and having someone check me on it every week was really helpful for me. And then we stopped and I was like, well, fuck, I'm never going to do this again. But then I did, and I had SNL in my goal list. But there's also like things that you can't control. So it's like the thing I could control was like, I would like to have done well at this showcase for SNL, and hopefully they call me in, kind of thing. And yeah, I looked at my notebook like a year later and I was like, oh, I did do all the goals. So it did stick. And now that teacher is my life coach, and we have a one-on-one Skype session every month to kind of reassess what's going on in my life. And like, now what goals do I have and how do I approach it this way? And it's really like, I like it a lot. I think it's really helpful. She doesn't like shame me. It's if I don't like, oh, you didn't finish this outline, so that's bad. It's like, okay, you didn't. Why didn't you? Maybe you don't think it's important right now. Maybe we should put that on the back burner and think of something else. And like, yeah, it's just thinking about, just analyzing how you're already thinking and just following those paths. It's like, okay, maybe I'm actually leaning more to this, I don't know, podcast idea or like this variety show idea. Maybe because I keep going that direction, so maybe I should follow that and see where it goes.
That is such a great answer. I'm like, me and everyone listening to this is like, well, who is this lady? How can we get in touch?
Her name is Betsy Capes. You can hit her up.
You're a walking advert for her. But for that sort of system, that's really inspiring to hear someone kind of taking the reins in that manner, because I think it's easy, certainly in the UK, to kind of the idea of self-help, you know, either self-help books or what have you, is, you know, it's probably, we probably feel similar about it that we do to therapy, which is that people who are into it are like, this is really great.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not kind of any shining examples of, oh, this is great and this is how it should work.
Yeah. I recommend therapy too. That really, even though, I mean, I don't know if you remember the joke about how my therapist was crazy, but...
Oh, yeah, of course.
She was a lunatic, but I did still feel like I got a lot out of therapy, and, I mean, as a creator, all I'm doing is talking about myself and how I relate to things in the world, and the more I know about myself, the better. So I would also recommend that people learn about yourself. What do you like? What do you not like? What are you striving for? What made you who you are today? What are the things in the past that you're trying to run away from? What are the skeletons in your closet you don't want to address anymore? Let's address them. Let's, you know, put that out there because maybe someone else can relate to that. Yeah, there's like so many ways that therapy opened up new doors in my mind where I was like, oh, I should probably be talking about this because it matters to me or it scares me and I need to get it out in some way. So... yeah, all that stuff is good. Just like exploring more things in your mind is only beneficial to your work.
So that was Sashir. Thank you very much to her and indeed her people for helping sort that out. Thanks to everyone, as ever, at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal, who are so kind to me and give me access to such exciting guests as Sashir and more besides. Coming up in the can, where's my little list of who's in the can? Currently in the can, it's got some very exciting people here. No, that's the hit list. I'm not reading that one out. That's the Charlie Big Potatoes hit list. Coming up, K. Trevor Wilson, in no particular order. This is Sean Patton, so brilliant. Julio Torres, you are going to love. You are going to talk about willpower in this Sashir episode. You are going to love hearing me ask Julio Torres, does he ever worry about it not working? And you will hear him look me right in the eye and say, no. It's a glorious episode. I can't wait to drop that one on you. And Sarah Kendall, brilliant. Joe Caulfield, brilliant. Zoe Coombs-Mars, Reg Hunter, Joe DeRosa, and Edmonds, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. All of those coming soon. I think next week, maybe we'll be in a position to record to release the Michael Legg one. So we'll take a brief bump from a bump out, as they say, instead of a get out in Australia. Aren't they weird with their ways? We will take a brief break from the Just for Laughs episodes to bring you Michael Legg, and then I think we're going to go for Reginald D. Hunter. That is a true blue bastard of an episode, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So I will chat to you in just a moment on the subject of willpower, if you would care to stick around for the post-amble, but if not, then I will speak to you next week. Bye for now. It's quite a long gap there between next week and bye for now. Just keeping on your toes. Bye for now. So, willpower. Oh, so listen, I've always had a problem with willpower. Can anyone say that they haven't? Can anyone truly say that, oh no, I just think of a thing and then do it? I think I probably made life a lot harder for myself than I needed to by assuming that I had some sort of ability to go, I'll think a thing and then do it, and then being really angry with myself when I didn't do that because I am only human. I think, you know, it's one of those things where I don't know why I thought this, if I just read far too many superhero comics or, you know, just interesting mythic stories, Neil Gaiman stuff, you know, all that kind of, I'm just absolutely obsessed with mythic archetypal stories, fairy tales being used and kind of retold and, you know, mythology and all those kind of things. Huge fan of all that stuff. Probably as a teenager spent far too much time assuming that I was the hero / main character. I'll talk about this a little bit in the Lost show, prick. But as we've discussed, I will never see the light of day. But I wonder if that's the reason, or if there's another reason why I probably made myself pretty unhappy by assuming an ability to get shit done that I turned out not to have. I mean, I do get things done. I've talked a little bit on the show before about whether or not I'm a workaholic or whether or not you're a workaholic. I certainly don't feel like one, but then they don't, do they? That's the whole reason they drive themselves. I did meet with a life coach once. Have I told you about this? I met with a life coach. I had a little sort of opening introductory chat in a coffee shop years ago with a life coach
And it seemed to me that it was someone who would say, you should... So tell me, what do you want to do? You should do that then. Now, obviously, there's more to it than that. But it did seem a little bit like if the problem I have is with willpower. That's not... I don't think I need a life coach. I'm doing a lot of the things I want to do. But what I need is someone who can teach me, if it's a learnable skill, if it's a learnable technique, I need someone who can teach me to actually follow through on things, to actually get out of bed in the morning and do things when no one else is there. When someone else is there, when there's a deadline to work towards, when there's stuff that needs to be done, I get it done. But this is the life of the traveling troubadour. You know, you often there isn't someone there saying, get this done. I've got much better at doing the washing up since becoming a parent. Have you experienced that since you became a parent, if indeed you did? I never wanted to be someone that did the washing up before going to bed. I was like, no, leave it. Do it in the morning when you can hate yourself, you know. But since parenthood, it's just got to be done. The only gift you can give yourself on those early mornings is the fact that you did the washing up last night. So I started doing that. So that suggests that self-discipline is learnable, given the right stakes. So is it something that someone can teach you? Is that job, is a self-discipline teacher, is that the same as a life coach? I don't think it is. But I just need, when someone's in the room, you know how you're a completely different person if someone's there? Are you? Is that just me? You're yourself in the context of other people, and you're like, yep, this is me, this is who I am. And then as soon as you're on your own, you sort of fall apart a bit and go, oh, I'm not going to do that now. I'm going to procrastinate and prevaricate and make myself unhappy so that I can be unhappy with myself. The amount of times I've gone to bed absolutely confident that tomorrow morning I'm going to get up and go for a run, and then not done that. And notably, a few years ago, wrote some really cracking material about how I hate people that go for runs, and sort of slapped my hands together in that job done way and thought, well, that's that resolved. I went for a run yesterday morning and gave up after 7 minutes. I can tell you, dear listener, because I know you won't judge me. 7 minutes. I think I'm ill. Okay, I should say I have allergy-related asthma. It took me years to work out the precise nature of that, but I have allergy-related asthma. I also get chest infections. I tend to over winter. God, is it winter yet? It almost is, isn't it? And so I need an inhaler. I forgot to I need an inhaler under certain circumstances. So I always forget to have it with me. I forget to take it. So I tried finally. I'd beat myself up for the requisite 6 months. I'm like, right, I'm going to do it. Took this morning. I make myself run. And I ran for 7 minutes and I stopped because I was so short of breath because I hadn't had a go on the inhaler. So I'm hoping that I'm just particularly ill or particularly allergic because I know I'm unfit, but I can't possibly be 7 minutes unfit. I can't be. But I do have this little voice in the back of my head going, well, you never do any regular exercise, so maybe I can be. 7 minutes? What do I do? What do I do? Have I got to? In the words of Rob Deering, his lovely song about running that you can find on his YouTube channel, I'm a father in my 40s and that's what we fucking do. I'm not admitting to any age there. I'm just saying I'm a... delete that, Daryl. No, leave it in! Leave it in! I've accidentally confessed to my age. Oh, Lord. Oh, God, that was the big birthday. I mean, you guessed as much, right? You guessed as much. But I'm... Look, oh, clearly, I mean, that's something about ageing. I didn't really share with you the fact that I'd turned 40, and it looks like I am now. And I used to have a lovely joke about this, which occasionally sneaks into an Edinburgh show and doesn't ever make it into the final version of it, which is simply that people tell me I look young and that's nice, but I'm not. I'm still going to die at the same time. That raw chicken may look fresh. It isn't. So my point is, do I really have to do that? Have I got to start running? Have I got to start running? Have I got to, given the lack of routine in my life that is always... taken the one way I think that people make themselves exercise is you get into a routine. The life of the comic has no routine, and I've got to do something because I don't want to die. I want to stay alive for the boy, for the wife, for you, for me. I want to stay alive. So I've got to do something. I've got to make. It's been 10 years of going, I'll get round to it. Do I really have to book myself into some sort of fucking marathon or some sort of fucking 5K or something. I hate it. I think I hate it. In my pathetic defence, I think I hate it because I probably had allergy-related asthma at school, but it wasn't diagnosed, so I associated the concept of running with having an incredibly painful, wheezing chest. And I never went, I think I might be different. I just assumed, and this is how I dealt with my entire childhood and teenage years and some of my current life. I just assumed that everyone was experiencing the same thing, but I was just doing it wrong or badly. So it was my fault. So I just never told anyone. So I think I grew to associate exercise with pain and fear. But okay, fine. Maybe I did. Maybe that was the association I made. The point is the same. I can't keep. So what am I going to do? Die aged 52, having just said, well, you know, it's reasonable, right? Because I made certain, you know, I learned my life a certain way when I was a kid. So I guess I'm going to die. I don't want that. Obviously, I don't want that. But what else is there? What else can I do? How can I get? I started doing a martial art. I won't go into details on it because I didn't commit to it hard enough that I feel I can claim it. I started doing a martial art because it was so much fun because it distracted me from the exercise, the very vigorous physical exercise I was doing. Obviously, I had a horrible moment, maybe not obviously, but I had one or two horrible moments in different classes of looking around and going, am I the old one here? Unfortunately, there tended to be at least one person older than me. I'd go, all right there, easy there, old timer, while I'm nearly blacking out on the sidelines. But even that, I couldn't keep it up. I kept getting injured and I couldn't stick to it in a regular kind of way. It ended up making me unhappy and frustrated. Have I got to start doing that again? I'd like to, but it's just the bloody regularity of it. Why can't someone do a regular class with a load of people at noon on a Monday? Can we do noon on a Monday at my house or near my house? Can we all do that? This is a pathetic rambler. I haven't post-ambled at you properly for some time, and I'm sorry that this one has been so pathetic. But I do worry about it. I'm a bit knocked by my 7-minute run yesterday. I mean, I'm sure I'm not 7 minutes unfit. I'm unfit, but I'm sure it's an inhaler issue, which I can easily test by doing it again. We're going trying for a run tomorrow, having taken some puffs on the inhaler, and then report back to you about how many minutes I lasted. Maybe that's the way. Maybe I need to, in that awful way that I specifically mocked in a routine a few years ago, which I believe you can hear in the show An Hour, currently available in all the places you buy things. I specifically mocked people telling everyone about their exercise, and maybe I need to do exactly that. Maybe that's why the poor bastards did it in the first place. And I totally unfairly rounded on them because actually they were just doing what they needed to do in order to keep going. So you've got to tell people, you've got to commit to it so that it's like a deadline. So maybe I have to start telling you about how long I can run for. God, no, I will not. That's not a separate Twitter account. Podface, I'll see if at Podface Death Run is available, and start trying to commit to something. Oh God, maybe I can just get fit by not exercising. That's got to be possible. It's got to be. Bye for now. Oh God.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.